KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Oh, yes, and by the way, Jack, how old are you?
Well, I'm in the neighborhood of 35.
I thought you moved from there.
I made the cranberry gingerbread muffins they have a recipe for, and they were a big hit in my family.
Making this change to our delivery schedule is a big ticket item, but it is simply too big of a cost savings to ignore.
You heard Jack Benny moving from the neighborhood of 35. We're going to talk about people who change their names and move around in the old-time radio era. We also heard Sarah Deckerman sounding a little under the weather there, talking about making muffins, but she's going to be in the studio talking about some great Vietnamese food. And you heard about from the Postal Service and what's happening with the Postal Service delivery on Saturday. We're taking that up this hour on weekday. I'm Steve Scher. We're also going to ask you to reflect back upon letters and writing letters. And if you still write letters, actually write them. Type them, write them, but compose the letter. What it means to you and what it'll mean that what it means that, you know, that art form is disappearing. Or is it? Maybe not. Maybe you'll say not. But let's start with what's happening with the Postal Service that used to deliver our letters. Billions of dollars in losses. Postal Service announcing yesterday that it's going to stop Saturday delivery of letters. It's a big change in mail delivery, historic change. Post Office said five-day mail delivery would begin in August, save them about $2 billion a year from those losses. Postal Service says it's going to continue to deliver packages 6 days a week, according to the New York Times, and there will be post offices still open on Saturdays as well. And as it says, as people say, reducing Saturday delivery, that's what has happened around the world. Australia, Canada, Sweden, letters just delivered 5 days a week. Apparently, we just don't write very many letters. And that is part of what we are talking about today and what that means. I want to start with Ernie Swanson. He works at the Seattle Division of the United States Postal Service. Ernie Swanson, thanks for talking to us.
You're quite welcome.
So with this announcement, it wasn't a surprise, but what did you detect in the mood among your coworkers?
Well, I think for the most part, postal employees have been expecting something like this. They're well aware that the Postal Service is in very dire financial situation and that certain measures have to be taken to stabilize us and keep us alive for the future. So I think most employees recognize that and understand that this is one of the measures that will help us temporarily, at least.
Do you think people are holding out that this is also a temporary measure?
No, I think the understanding is that if we do this, it will become permanent.
You know, will there be any job losses in the area because of this?
Well, there'll be reduction in our overall complement, probably estimated nationwide at somewhere around 20 to 22,000 positions. The Postal Service has reduced its complement by about 193,000 positions in the last 6 years, and we've done that through attrition, which is resignations and retirements. So right now we're operating quite leanly, and the hope and the expectation is that we can move to this five-day delivery of letter mail without having to lay off anyone. We would simply absorb the losses, and because of the reductions we've already experienced, and that we would not have to lay off. That doesn't mean that some people might not have to change their hours that they work, their days off, might even have to change locations, but we hope to be able to do this and offer everyone who's interested at least a job.
Some people go into part-time then, maybe, in some parts of the area.
Well, there's a certain amount of protection in the union contract that almost guarantees 8 hours of work a day for our career employees.
Yeah, that's one of the complaints people have, right? In trying to fund the post office, they have to pay people, and people cost money.
Well, absolutely. I mean, that doesn't mean that they don't have work. We're talking largely here about letter carriers, of course, with delivery of mail. And we've reduced our letter carrier routes by over 20,000 in the last few years simply because of the declining volume means carriers have less mail to deliver so they can make their routes longer. So we've been able to eliminate, as I say, over 20,000 routes throughout the country. and make us as more efficient.
By the way, any benefits affected by this change from Saturday delivery?
No, this shouldn't make any difference. Each of our postal unions have recently renegotiated new contracts, and I think each of the unions is going to be contributing more to their own health benefits, but there shouldn't be any loss of benefits.
You know, you hear the complaints from people, Ernie Swanson and the post office, that, you know, all we get are mailers and junk mail and solicitations for credit cards or joining various organizations. And why do I have to get that junk mail? And that's what it's called, junk mail, by those people who don't like it. How do the postal delivery workers feel about what they're delivering? Do you ever hear any comments?
No, I don't directly, but I think the postal employees understand that helps pay their salary. And you're right, not all customers enjoy getting advertising mail, but the advertising community, businesses realize that it's successful. They wouldn't be paying the kind of money they do to produce those pieces and mail them if it didn't work. So I think our delivery people understand that it's part of the job and that it helps pay the bills.
Do people ever talk about, in the post office, do they ever talk about the fact that people don't use the post office for personal communications as much as they used to? Do they ever either bemoan it or wonder about it?
Well, certainly. It's a topic of conversation. Our first-class mail volume, which of course is letters and correspondence and bill payments, is down by over 25% in the last half a dozen years. And the first-class mail pays a large share of the postal expenses. So that's a real source of concern, and it's a source of concern among postal employees as well. It certainly impacts the future of the organization.
Yeah, and there's not as many people buying cool stamps.
That's true, too.
You know, do you know the history? Has Saturday mail service always been a part of American postal service?
Well, it goes back into the 1800s. My understanding is that at one time we actually delivered mail on Sundays, and then sometime around the 1920s, apparently the religious lobby roared up and said, hey, you're hurting church attendance by having postal services available on Sundays. So we yielded to that and discontinued it. And there was like a short period of time in the 1940s when we stopped the Saturday delivery of mail because of an extreme financial situation at that time, but we got some immediate relief from Congress and resumed it after just a matter of short period of time.
So what, people were thinking that they were spending all their time reading and writing letters, and so they weren't going to church, huh?
That's apparently what the the church lobby felt.
Interesting. All right, so this is accurate, correct? You'll still be delivering packages on Saturday. That's in part to maintain your competition with the UPS and the other companies that deliver packages, and some post offices will still be open?
Those post offices that are open on Saturday now will continue to be open the same hours. And yes, we will continue to deliver parcels on Saturday. Our parcel business is about the only segment of our business that is growing. It's up about 14% in the last 2 years. So people do use us to send parcels, fortunately, since our letter volume is falling off. And part of this is when we suggested or mentioned the possibility of eliminating Saturday delivery back in 2009, a lot of the rural customers, particularly older folks who rely on the mail to get prescription medications, those sort of things, were very concerned that Saturday delivery might impact that. So we've taken all of that into account. And that's part of the reason why we're going to continue to deliver parcels and packages on Saturdays.
You know, how is the Seattle area compared to the rest of the nation in terms of percentage of people still using first-class mail? Do you know? Do you have any statistics on that?
No, I don't have statistics specifically, but of course, Seattle area is one of those areas that's very much into computers and the internet, and we're kind of technologically advanced, I think, over some other parts of the country. So the expectation would be that probably a good percentage of the population here does, in fact, use the internet for bill paying and communication and things like Twitter and Facebook, and all of which might have resulted in a letter or a card previously sent through the mail.
Yeah, I've heard people say a long time ago the post office should have somehow gotten right in the middle of the internet as a way to maintain their place in the delivery of information in that sense. But that didn't happen.
No, that's a niche that we're not really set up to deal with. We have an extremely popular website. It's one of the most popular websites in the business world. Well over 1 million hits a month, people looking up zip codes and mailing information and that sort of thing. But that obviously doesn't directly impact the volume of mail.
Do people get the stamps that they buy? Do they get them? They don't get them directly from the post office that they want, like the attractive stamps and the like. I mean, from the website.
You can order postage stamps off the website.
But then they get mailed to you.
Yes, they get mailed to you. That's right. And there's no surcharge for having them mailed to you. You obviously have to pay for the stamps, but we will send them to you. But most post offices have a representative sample of the current stamps, and we still issue 20 to 25 commemorative stamps a year because there is a stamp collecting group out there that still collects those sort of things.
Yeah.
So we continue to do that, and there's a lot of very popular stamps. We just issued a Rosa Parks stamp this week that's getting a lot of attention, a lot of publicity.
But because of security and commerce, you can't print them from the post office direct with those sort of commemorative stamps right to your printer.
Oh, no, you can't do that.
Yeah. Is Congress going to accept this idea of going to Saturday service? They could still fight it, couldn't they, if they didn't like it?
They can still fight it, and there's some question about whether we could legally do this on our own, but Postmaster General said yesterday that he believes we can. He's had our legal counsel look into it, and we feel that the timing is right. Obviously, Congress could still do something to block it. We certainly hope they don't. We're still hopeful that they'll come up with some legislation that will provide us some other assistance as well. The comments I've seen from members of Congress seem to go back and forth. Some think this is a very bad thing to do. Others think that it's inevitable and that the timing is probably right and that we need to do something. $2 billion a year that this would save us is pretty significant.
All right, Ernie Swanson, I appreciate you taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you, Steve. Appreciate the opportunity.
Ernie Swanson is with the Seattle Division of the United States Postal Service, and as we were talking about, you heard that they have decided to opt for eliminating first-class delivery of mail on Saturday. They're still going to do packages, which got us thinking about letter writing again. We've had a few shows over the years about letters. We even did a show where people read us letters that they had received that had changed their lives. Do you still write a letter? Obviously, many few of us are, because that's why the Post Service is having some issues. We're all sending email. And email can be an engagement, but it's not quite the same as sitting down with pen and paper and writing a letter. So we thought we'd ask you to talk a little bit about letter writing. If it's part of your life, if it was part of your life, if there have been correspondence that you have maintained or maintained for a while that had an impact on your life, maybe you have some aspects, some little short bits of letters you can share with us. We'll take a break and we'll come back and think about letter writing in the modern age. That's ahead on Weekday.
It's 1019, KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
KUOW would like to thank Microsoft and its employees, the Real Networks Foundation, the Kongsgaard Goldman Foundation, the Cape Flattery Foundation, and our other corporate and private foundation contributors for their support of public radio and their commitment to building a vibrant community through corporate contributions and foundation grants.
45 degrees in Seattle, and depending upon your perspective, it's either partly cloudy or partly sunny. Forecast says a little bit of sun through the day, also a chance of scattered showers and a high of 47. Later this hour, we go from old school letter writing to old time radio. You know Jack Benny? Do you know that Jack Benny wasn't his birth name? He changed it. And he's not the only old time radio star who changed his name. We'll learn more about who did and why at 10:35.
But first, we're going to talk about your letters. So, do you still write letters? And what kind of pen do you use? What kind of pencil do you use? I mean, are you writing letters thing? Are you still practicing putting something in your hand and writing it out? If so, share some stories with us about that. Or if you've had letters that have been a part of your life, affected your life, let us know. Our number is 206-543-5869, 1-800-289-5869. We'd like a few stories from you about letters and how they've affected your life. You can also email us, weekday@kuow.org. I'm going to read some of the letters that you have sent me via email about your letter writing in a moment. Katie Sewell's here because we were thinking about this, and in a bit I want to talk to you about your own letter writing experience, but also you talked to somebody who made his career through letters, right?
Yes, I did. And you have his title over there.
So. Nick Bannock?
Yeah.
I have Nick Bannock's title. He's an artist and author. 25 books. Griffin and Sabine, that was the one that was very well known, an extraordinary correspondence. It's on the New York Times bestseller list for 2 years. And it was all told through letters. And he did a couple of books about letters.
Yeah, and a lot of his art has postage stamps and things like that, or postcards in them. So I thought he was the perfect person to ask about letters. So I asked him, why do you write letters? And he seemed surprised that I would even ask him such a question.
Why? Because they're hugely different to email. Email's handy and efficient and quick, cheap, and cheerful. But writing letters has a completely different emotional and aesthetic feel to it.
What do you think would be lost if people stopped writing handwritten letters?
We'd lose a large chunk of our capacity to communicate in depth. I mean, as Orwell says, you take away people's ability to articulate and you take away their ability to think. And writing is just a form of articulation.
One of the interesting things when we started talking about this as a topic was Amina was saying that writing handwritten letters for her is just difficult because her hand muscles aren't even used to doing it anymore. So her hand gets really tired.
That's very true. I mean, the latest statistics show the very, very high percentage of people over the 20 can't produce cursive handwriting. I mean, let alone produce something that has a real quality to it. So, yeah, the kind of flow that passes from your feelings and your brain directly down your arm through your hand. So as you write, you find your thoughts and your emotions actually spill onto the page. That doesn't happen if you're not holding a pen and using it on a regular basis.
Nick Bantock is an artist and author of 25 different books, including Griffin and Sabine, An Extraordinary Correspondence, which was on the New York Times bestseller list for over 2 years. And that story is told through letters between two main characters. How often do you think you write letters?
It varies massively. I mean, these days, I probably only write, you know, sort of 3 or 4 a week. But there was one time, I mean, when Griffin and Sabine first came out back in the 90s, I was writing hundreds of letters a week.
Who to?
The people who were writing to me, basically. It was strange because I did the book in the first place almost as a reaction to not getting any mail and deciding that I was going to write this story between two people writing to each other. And ironically, out comes the book, and then hundreds of people start writing to me.
What do you think it would take to make the handwritten letter something that was common again?
I honestly don't think you could turn it around just like that. There's no way that you can reverse this juggernaut of technological progress, in parentheses. But I do think there is always a chance that another generation will discover that the pure physical pleasure of putting pen to paper and adding imagery to it.
That's Nick Bantock. He's an artist, author.
Who is that?
Nick Bantock. Artist, author of 25 books, including Griffin and Sabine, which is a story that's told through two people writing letters. He does have a new book coming out next January called The Trickster's Hat.
All right, so we're talking about letters. Katie's going to tell us a little more about some letters, but I want to hear from you as well. And Is that Gloria on Bainbridge Island?
Yes, it's Gloria on Bainbridge Island.
Good to talk to you.
Yeah.
You still writing letters?
I am still writing letters, in part because you can communicate with pretty much anybody in the world with a letter in a way that you can't on email. And the other is that it's been reinforced for me, the importance of them. One, my grandmother, when I was 6 and 7, I remember right after Christmas, she'd make us write thank you letters almost before we'd open the gift. And at the time, I hated it, and now I really love it. I love how people feel when they get a thank you letter. And finally, I was reinforced that because my mother died when I was 3 and a half, and so I really had no way of knowing her at the time that she died. There was, you know, there was recording equipment, but I don't have home movies or anything that I have pictures. And my father, who was a saver, saved all the letters that people had written to her during her hospital stay, which was 4 months, and at the end of her life. And also, he asked people to write letters to my sister and me to describe who our mother was, how they met her, and what she meant to them. And it's just meant so much to me. I've had those letters for over 50 years now, and they give me strength. They have explained family members to me who wrote to her. I see sides of him them that I never knew, and some of them are people I never met, but a lot of them are people that remained friends of mine throughout my life. So I just think letters are invaluable.
You know, you said one thing I want you to tell me. Why can you write something in a letter that you can't write in email?
Well, for one thing, there are people in the world who aren't connected to email.
Well, there's that. Good point there.
I wrote. I met her when I was 21, and she just died last summer, and we kept a correspondence for 38 years. And she was a nurse. She didn't have access to email, and nor did I 30 years ago. And it was just so wonderful. On every holiday or birthday, you know, we would make sure we'd be in touch. And the other is, when you get a letter, you know, sometimes picking a card and then writing a letter on it, or if someone's done something very special for me, my first instinct is to, if it's something brief, you know, I just wrote a friend, you know, this morning saying what a good statement he made in front of our city council last night. Well, you know, that doesn't need to be in a letter, but I had a conversation with someone the other day about a very important subject, and I just felt like it just called out to have a letter written about what that meant to me rather than just dash off an email. So
that's very good. Yeah. Gloria, it's very good. I appreciate that. I appreciate you calling, because that's very nice. I do want to mention that we like getting postcards all the time.
That's and true.
Anytime somebody wants to send us a postcard, you know, a letter is fine. I like a letter, like a postcard, same sort of thing. My mom saved all our letters, and we have all those letters now from all my sisters. She saved them all. It's interesting to see your own history.
Yeah.
You were looking at your grandmother's letters.
I was. As you know, my grandmother died on Monday really early in the morning, and so for the last few days and actually leading up to her death, I dug out all these letters that I had from her from the years. We used to write each other a lot, and I used to ask her very pointed questions about things I wondered about our family history. And so the letters have served as kind of a log. It's why I know how my grandparents met. It's why I know that she went skinny dipping with some friends on a whim in high school. It's how I know that if she hadn't passed a test after 8th grade, the township would have dropped her as far as her education was concerned, where she lived in rural Pennsylvania. And it's also just the little tiny details, like you were asking me, do I have any of her letters in my drawer here at work? And I found one. And on one of them, it just says, last night we had Italian night at our retirement home. And one of the women next to her leaned over and said, they're trying to keep things interesting for us. You know, like little details like that. Plus, you know, you have a record of her handwriting, and some of her emotion kind of spills out onto the page.
I think that's what's so critical, the handwriting as well, even my terrible handwriting. So here's what Jenny wrote. I sent 2 handwritten letters to friends this morning. They were on beautiful paper with stamps I had picked at the post office to match my personal tastes. No Liberty Bells for me. Letter writing for me is a way to slow down, make a personal connection, and add some beauty to the world. And Bruce writes, Seattle friends, very interesting show. Thank you. Wanted to bring your... Yeah, you know, he likes letters, which is all about the art and impact of writing letters by hand. It's at a website, heartspoken.com. And Allison's in Seattle. Hi, Allison.
Hi.
You birthday cards. You send birthday cards?
You know, I just wrote a birthday card this morning to my sister. And amongst my immediate family, we always write each other birthday cards. We're all living in different places. And I think our mom really instilled that in us from an early age, probably to starting with forcing us to write thank you notes. But that really made us start writing letters and appreciating it. And wherever my sister and I have lived, my mom always writes us letters, you know, whether it's a postcard from a restaurant where she and my dad are eating that night or little trips they take. I love receiving letters from her. And then also my grandparents, like everyone has mentioned so far, their handwriting and having a record of their handwriting after they're gone is really important to me.
That's great. Thank you for that. Thank you. And here's what Paige wrote. I love to choose the right cards, just the right stamps and beautiful stationery. I enjoy putting pen to paper and practicing pretty penmanship. I really love to do little things to show the folks I care about how special they are to me. I sent 3, for no particular reason, letters last week. All 3 recipients are people with whom I text and Skype with frequently. Seems relevant to say I'm 32 years old. 2 letter writing from Paige. And Peggy in Shoreline, there's a value in having the old letters, right?
Yes, I do. And a lot of the things that were already said, I would say as well, but the 2 most important things I want to say is that I have every letter that my mom and dad wrote to each other during the war when they were separated, and it is the most beautiful correspondence, and, I mean, there's hundreds of them, and she was pregnant with me at the time, and then had me, and all of our, you know, she told him all about the baby and everything that was going on. Anyway, the other thing I wanted to tell you was she also saved every letter that we wrote to her and Dad through the years. And so when they died, we each got a box of our own letters back. And it's like a journal. I have my journal of my life during that period, at least what I would have told my parents. and then the 3rd thing I just must say is that my granddaughter, who's 11, they're not teaching script anymore.
Right.
I am just sick about it because I said to her, "What? How are you going to read all our wonderful memoirs?" She can't even read my writing in script, and I do it very carefully for her. It is really a tragedy that they're stopping that because it's an important thing.
Peggy, I appreciate that, and you're going to like this email. Then you won't like it, but this is right to your point. This is from Christine. She says, this isn't about letters per se, but I teach at the UW. I routinely give essay exams. Halfway through, the students are clearly in physical pain, stretching out their fingers, shaking their hands. They aren't used to writing this much at all. And David in Columbia City, I got time for 2 quick comments here. So, David, it's a form of art as you see it, yes?
It is a form of art, you know. And I mean, I feel like it's a soon to be quickly lost form of art, especially when you were commenting on the fact that a lot of people that, you know, are under 20 years old, can't even, you know, do cursive writing anymore. I think the author of the book had mentioned that a little bit ago. But go ahead. I know you're pressed for time, so.
All right, but I appreciate that. I think about that as a personal art form as well, even though I look at my own handwriting and I know how terrible it was. All right, Linda, in Bellevue, you get the last comment here on this, the question of letters.
Okay. Can do is say if I were sending you an email, it would just go exclamation point, exclamation point, exclamation point. You would probably tell me that was poor etiquette. But I just love to write and always have, and it's emotional and it's personal and it's touching and it reaches me in a way that I feel allows other people to be reached by me. So thank you. Thank you so much for having this question.
Thank you. And, you know, even though the post office is not delivering on Saturday, you can still write letters and feel free to write us. We like getting letters. Frith said, my oldest friend in the world is Anna Bertinelli, who I began writing to over 30 years ago. We were connected as pen pals, me in Australia, her in Italy. We have met 4 times. I treasure her friendship, have every letter she ever sent me. This is Weekday.
Well, like Steve said, as long as you're thinking about it, why not send us a letter or a postcard? KUOW's mailing address is 4518 University Way Northeast, Suite 310, Seattle, 98105. Pop us a letter in the mail. We'll look forward to opening the envelope and reading it.
Support for KUOW comes from Franz Chocolates, celebrating 30 years of handcrafting confections in Seattle, now featuring new Valentine's gift assortments. At Franz Downtown at First and Union, in University Village, on Old Main Street in Bellevue, and online at franzchocolates.com.
A new movie about teenage romance has a not-so-typical leading man. He's a zombie.
Yeah, being a zombie is not that different from being a shy kid. You know, you're trapped in your own body. Like, this guy thinks he's a total loser.
Oh, well, later today we'll teach you more about the striking similarities between zombies and love-struck teens. That's on All Things Considered from NPR News. Everybody's got a hungry
heart. That's later today on KUOW's Afternoon News Magazine. Today from 3 to 8 p.m.
KUOW and the Northwest African American Museum present Seattle writer Nancy Rawls, kicking off a year-long conversation series with Race and Sexuality, Two Sides of a Double-Edged Coin, February 16th at 6 p.m. at NAM. Learn more on the events page at KUOW.org.
46 degrees and partly sunny in Seattle. Forecast says partly sunny through the day, chance of scattered showers and a high of 47. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 10:36. Sarah Dickerman, food blogger, will join us to recommend a cookbook and a lunch nook in 10 minutes.
Quiet, please. In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
This is Jack Benny talking. Jordan, Rocky Jordan.
Have you ever danced with a murderer?
This is Orson Welles, speaking from London. King County.
Now we cast our gaze back into the golden age of radio. I didn't quite do that right. And now we cast our way back into the golden age of radio. I'm Steve Scher with Katie Sewell. Hello, Katie.
Hello, Steve.
John Stewart, who I get my news from. Jonathan Liebowitz. Whoopi Goldberg. Karen Johnson. See, I would not have paid attention to Karen Johnson like I pay attention to Whoopi Goldberg. Performers use stage names. Radio people use stage names. And that's what you were thinking about today, eh?
Yes. And the list goes on and on. If you go farther back, Cary Grant was named Archibald Leach.
Now, see, I would have paid attention to Archibald Leach.
No, it's a great name, really.
Cary Grant is, like, what was his famous comment? I don't really know Cary Grant. And he says something, I don't think I'm getting it quite right. But, you know, he said, well, neither do I. Oh, I'd like to meet Cary Grant, so would I. That was it.
Jean Harlow was Harlene Carpenter.
Yeah, that,
in
yeah.
Real life.
Yeah, there you go.
Rita Hayworth had the name, first name, Margarita. In real life, Margarita Cincenso was her name.
Margarita Cincenso. That would have been okay. But, I mean, Jean Harlow, Rita Hayworth, Cary Grant, they had this idea, those folks, about what Hollywood thought they were selling us. And Margarita was not the same as Rita.
Yes. And sometimes these stage names come about accidentally. And so as a way of talking about it as far as radio is concerned, because, of course, radio is no exception to this. I decided to pick on one show that stood out for the overwhelming number of cast members who were not actually using their real names. This show.
J-E-L-L. Oh.
The Jell-O program, starring Jack Benny with Mary Livingston and Phil Harris and his orchestra. The orchestra opens the program with Right or Wrong from Happy Go Lucky.
Now let me start by saying that none of those names you just heard are their real names.
Really?
Nope. Jack
not
Benny,
even Phil
Mary
Harris?
Livingston, Phil Harris, not their birth names. So let's start with Jack Benny, shall we?
Ladies and gentlemen, on this same Valentine's Day many years ago in the little town of Waukegan, Illinois, there was cause for great rejoicing. For on that day, in a certain household, a little bundle of joy made his entrance into the world. So now we bring you...
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday.
So Jack Benny was actually born Benjamin Kubelski, and he performed under that name in vaudeville until a famous violinist named Jan Kubelik was threatened him with legal action. Apparently, he was worried that Benjamin Kubelski would damage his reputation.
Because he wasn't quite the same kind of a violin player, huh?
Right. So Benjamin Kubelski changed his name to Ben K. Benny at that time. After the war, Ben K. Benny started doing a solo act on vaudeville called Ben K. Benny Fiddle Phonology. And that threatened Ben Bernie, who was another fiddle performer, who also threatened legal action. And that's how he ended up being Jack Benny.
Oh, yes, and by the way, Jack, how old are you?
Well, I'm in the neighborhood of 35.
I thought you moved from there.
Yes, but not far. On a clear day, I can still see 35.
So you heard Mary Livingstone there. That was Jack Benny's wife in real life. She was born with the name Sadie Marks.
Sadie Marks.
And she kept her name for quite some time. She didn't change hers until after marrying Jack Benny. She appeared in some of his vaudeville shows, but she, Steve, interestingly enough, never really liked performing. And she was very happy when Jack moved to radio and she could just stop performing on stage altogether.
She didn't like being on stage because she's very good on the radio.
She didn't even like being performing at all.
Oh.
So one day, the reason she ends up on the radio is Jack calls home in a panic, asking her to come down to the studio immediately. Apparently, the actress he had booked for the evening show just hadn't shown up. And they were about to go live. And so Sadie Marks filled in playing a character on the show named Mary Livingstone.
Huh.
She was supposed to be a one-time character, but NBC got a lot of fan mail about her, and so the character became permanent.
Jack, I'm going to give you a great big kiss.
Hmm. Uh-huh. Huh? Mary, how was that?
Not bad.
Pretty good, huh?
No, just not bad.
So the name actually becomes permanent. She gives up Sadie Marks when she finally gives in to the public because she's out and about and the public keeps calling her Mary Livingstone. She decides, well, what the heck? I might as well just change my name to that. And after a while, Jack said it was weird calling her Sadie.
It's so funny because Andy wrote this too. I agree. Sadie Marks is a great name.
It is a great name. But She became Mary Livingstone to the public. So yeah. Bowed to the pressure. Now, what about this guy?
Mr. Benny, if it'll get you out of this mess, why don't you make the reward substantial? Give her $1,000. Well, we're back to killing yourself.
So that's the character Rochester Van Jones.
Is that what he was called? Rochester Van Jones?
Yes. Didn't know the last name?
No.
Rochester as a name also was one that caught on with the public. The actor that played Rochester became widely known as Eddie Rochester Anderson.
Right.
Which was not his birth name, which was Edmund Lincoln Anderson.
Oh.
Neither Jack Benny nor Eddie Anderson could remember years later how they ended up coming up with the name Rochester for that character. But Jack Benny did copyright that name once it became popular. And once Eddie Rochester Anderson was being known that way, he was nice enough to sell Eddie the Rochester copyright for $1.
Oh, that's funny.
Side note, I was interested to learn that the reason his voice sounds like that was because he was a paper boy screaming paper headlines as a kid. And back in those days, apparently him and his friends thought whoever could yell the loudest would sell the most papers, and he permanently damaged his vocal cords.
Dang.
Side note, kids, don't yell too much.
Don't yell a lot, kids. Just what your parents would tell you.
Yeah.
For Eddie, it turned out to be true. All right.
So let's do some rapid fire, shall we?
Dennis Day?
Dennis Day was born Patrick Eugene McNulty.
Really? That's a pretty good name.
Yeah.
All right. Phil Harris?
Phil Harris was pretty much Phil Harris, except he dropped his first name, which was Wonga.
Wonga?
Wonga Philip Harris.
Wonga?
So he went by Phil Harris instead.
Come on, he made that up. Wonga?
Nope.
All right, Don Ameche?
Don Ameche was born very close to that, Dominic Amici.
Amici. Dominic Amici.
Yes, and that's not counting all the guest stars that had stage names, too.
Wow.
And just to end, because I thought it would be fun, there's at least one person at KYW who uses a name other than the one she was born with.
Hi, I'm Rainey Cohen, and I'm an announcer here at KYW. I was born as Christine Rain. So when I was in eighth grade, my best friend, we shared a locker, and she left me a note one day, and she was like, I have an idea. We can call you Rainey, because my last name is Rain. And I had never really identified with my first name before and had wanted to change it my entire life. And so at the age of 14, I decided that I was now Rainey. Unfortunately, that makes me Rainey Rain.
I could see why that would be a problem, although not an unmemorable radio name?
No. And for my first couple of years in radio, I just had one name. I was just Rainey with no last name. And then at a second radio station, the guy I worked with liked the alliteration of Rainey Rain, so we called me Rainey Rain. I transitioned into reporting news. And Rainey Rain is not a very, like, credible sounding name. So I needed a new last name. And I had I still have a bunch of friends who are Jewish. And I was talking to my friend on the phone. I need help. I need to find a new last name. And she said, well, it has to be a Jewish name. And so she started throwing things out and she said, how about Finkelstein? And I said, absolutely not. And we tossed a few more things around and Cohen sounded good. And so there was born Rainey Cohen.
This is kind of a morbid question, maybe. But when you die, is it going to say Rainey Cohen on your gravestone like it would say Jack Benny on his?
It will not, but I'm getting married this summer. And when I take my fiance's last name, I will go ahead and make the legal switch to Rainey. So I will be Rainey Kendo, but that will not change on the radio.
You'll be Rainey Cohen.
I'll be Rainey Cohen for as long as I'm behind a microphone.
Did you know all that?
No. So she's going to make Rainey her official name.
Yeah. She'll always be Rainey Cohen on the radio.
I like the idea of just having one name, Rainey, like that.
Yeah. It'd be like Cher.
Cher. That's been taken, though.
You could. Your last name is Cher. You could be Cher.
It's been taken.
Oh.
Okay. I don't know. Maybe I need a better radio name that would give me a little more punch.
Maybe I do, too.
Katie Sewell. You think that's...
It's a little diminutive. Or maybe forgettable, hard to pronounce, hard to spell.
Who are some women who have really powerful powerful names that you think would work? What should we call you?
Well, there's people with really odd names like Lakshmi Singh.
That's a good
a
name.
A lot of people can pull out.
Yeah.
Jason Pagano and I were joking about calling me Katie Christmas.
Katie Christmas.
What's not to like about Christmas?
Katie Christmas is not bad. It gives you a whole different flavor.
It makes me sunnier.
Makes you sunny. It makes you...
Twinkling.
Katie Christmas.
Indisputable.
Joining us now, Katie Christmas.
For KUOW, I'm Katie Christmas. But no, I would love to hear people's suggestions. Feel free to send us other ideas of stage names that Steve and I should be using.
Yes. Or you know what? I'll tell you what. Also, we'll put it on Facebook. So you can email us weekday@KUOW.org. But let's put it up on Facebook. And also, suggest some for us or other people at KUOW. As long as they're civil. But how about your own? What would your stage name be? So that's going to be, and have fun with that. We'll see what's up on KUOW, and we'll read a few next time around, see what kind of stage names are out there.
Maybe tomorrow.
Yeah, that's very good. All right. Thank you, Katie Christmas.
You're welcome,
Cher.
Stephen.
Yeah,
Cher.
I don't got anything. Bernard, you got anything for me? I have nothing. Stephen Arbordet. Yeah, very good. Stephen Green. All right. Thank you. This is Weekday. Nice piece of music. Sarah Dickerman, I like that sound. That's a good sound. That's a good way to come into an Eaton.
Very peppy.
That's very peppy. Oh, it keeps going. That's got a nice beat, and you can dance to it. Or, in this case, you can eat to it. Sarah Dickerman writes for Slate, New York Times, blogs at sarahdickerman.com. She just finished her, what did you call that? A cleansing? What was that called?
I didn't call it. My editors called it the Food Lover's Cleanse.
That's right, the Food Lover's Cleanse.
Which was bonappetit.com. And it's a great source for, year-round, it's a good source for healthy recipes. Check it. And
yeah.
I did a lot of recipes for it.
What is this book you have? You said you thought you had lost this book?
Okay, yeah. So you know how sometimes in your home you you lose something, but you're like, oh, I'm sure I'll find it.
Oh, yeah.
Eventually it will turn up. And finally I confessed to myself that I had lost my Marcella Hazan cookbook, The Essentials of Classic Italian Cooking, which is actually a composite of two 1970s books that she wrote. edited by the same editor as Julia Child, the great Judith Jones, and is essentially serves the same function for American home cooks with Italian cooking as Julia Child did, although she wasn't as big a TV star.
But this is an important book to you. Her work is important.
Yeah. I think she still has this voice, even after all these years of interesting and great Italian cookbooks. She has a voice that's clear, concise. And I think it's a great cookbook for novice cooks or people who are starting a cookbook library. Not because it's super easy. There's some really easy recipes, and then there's some more complex ones like boning out a whole chicken and stuffing it with pork. But for the basics, there's a beautiful roast chicken. One of the first recipes I learned as a grown-up was this roast chicken that has two lemons put into the cavity that sort of baste the chicken as you roast it. There's a great, very simple, something in between a cake and a pudding called a farm wife's fresh pear tart. And it's basically like a whole bunch of pears with a simple batter that you pour over it. And it bakes up, like I said, not quite like a custard and not quite like a cake. It's somewhere in between. It's delicious and so simple to make. So that's one of the reasons I love it.
I checked to see anchovies because I've been really into baking with and cooking with anchovies because as I mentioned, I was reading this book that had a detective series, but it had a bunch of anchovy recipes in it. And he was always using anchovy. And then I went to Maria Hines Agua Dolce, her new restaurant, and it's all Southern Italian cooking and Sicilian cooking. Yeah. And that's, of course, anchovies.
Well, anchovies are magic. I will give you that.
Beef patties baked with anchovies, fish steaks sauced with white wine and anchovies. Oh, that sounds very interesting to try those. Veal roll with mozzarella and anchovies?
Yeah, because anchovies are like this stealth ingredient. I didn't know you were going to bring up anchovies today, and I love anchovies. But they're an amazing ingredient because you can put them in so many things that people would never know they're in unless you told them. Because what it does is adds, you know, I've talked about it before, it adds umami to a dish. It just adds this richness that you can't quite put your finger on. I think that one of the most amazing things to do with anchovies is to, when you're sautéing maybe a little garlic before you cook greens like chard or kale, put an anchovy or two in there, toss it with the greens, and it will just, you know, it will melt into the oil, but it just gives it that little something. That's why we love Caesar salad, of course.
Yes. That sounds, I don't think I want to do that. So when you saute garlic, by the way, I was reading that some people were saying, who was it? Was it my friend Jacques? Add it at the end rather than the beginning because you don't want it to burn. You're worried about it burning.
You are worried about it burning. So in the case of greens, usually I pull my greens out of the wash water. So I let the garlic warm up in the oil, but then I put my greens in with a little bit of the wash water and then it's steaming. So effectively it's stopping the burning process.
And
you're right. It, in some cases, you just want, if you add a hit of garlic and then just at the end and just cook for, you know, 30 seconds to a minute, you'll just get that pungency and that bright, beautiful flavor without worrying about overcooking it.
Where would the anchovy go in that time frame for the
recipe? In mine, I do it at the beginning, so it really melts into the oil.
Very cool.
Really.
This is a nice looking book.
Oh, it's beautiful. Even the typesetting is
Italian
beautiful.
Cooking.
That's back when they had a lot of money for typesetting, I think, too.
So what's this one? Why did you? Is this here just because you? The LA Bay, you have this book from the LA Bay Book Company, or you were interested in sautéed scallops with garlic and parsley, or Aristocini Abruzzese.
It's happenstance. What's in that one?
Skewered marinated lamb tidbits.
Oh, that sounds wonderful.
Lamb shoulder, garlic, pepper, marjoram, and then the skewers.
Yeah, and that's a great, the other nice thing is it's not a terribly regional cookbook, but it will give you a sense of you know, in Abruzzo, you're going to get a lot of interesting meat dishes. And, you know, then it has some Sicilian flavor. So you can begin to sense what the regions of Italy are.
This book is fun. Braised artichokes and leeks, braised artichokes and potatoes.
Oh, yeah. And you know that we're coming close to one of the classic times of the year. A couple of months, but there's the great artichoke dish that she has in here, which is the combination of fava beans and artichokes and peas and sometimes you put a little fresh mint in there.
I've never had
it. Like, it's pure spring. And in Italy, of course, the artichokes come early. So it's a little bit of an earlier dish in Italy, but it's that pure, verdant yumminess.
What kind of artichokes are you using? in a dish like that? Are you using a heart? Are you using those little artichokes?
Yeah, well, you have to trim them.
Right.
And I think she has the process for trimming them in here. Or you could look it up online. Or super secret, you know, frozen artichoke hearts aren't the worst things in the world.
No.
And they take the work out of it for you.
Marcella Hazan's Essentials of Classic Italian Cooking. By the way, braising.
Yes.
I was talking to a guy earlier this week, Eddie Huang, who...
That was a good interview.
He's so attentive to his food and the ingredients. But he talked about braising, and I have different ideas of what braising is. What is braising?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, it's sort of based in the original sort of put a pot in the fire idea. So generally, I'd say braising moisture with whatever you're braising. Could be meat, could be vegetables. Moisture covered, low temperature is basically, and you might brown it before you start that low temperature business.
Oh, I see.
So it's, you know, cooking with steam, essentially.
One of the things he described was blanching a piece of meat, mm-hmm. and then taking it out and then doing the ingredients and then later adding it at a higher heat and browning it, which was, seemed like mm-hmm. the opposite, but it was a different flavor going for.
It's really interesting when you start looking around the world. I mean, we're used to browning first and then braising, but something like a Moroccan cookbook, if you look through Paula Wolfert's cooking, she'll often start out with very low temperature and then it ends up with the browning at the end.
Say, now we're going to now for something completely different.
Yes.
Greenleaf Vietnamese restaurants.
Yes. So we mentioned it at the end of the show last week. I just wanted to give it a little moment. There's several of them. There's one newer one in Belltown in the Labor Temple. And I just find it such a solid choice for good Vietnamese food. And especially if you want to branch out from pho, which of course I love, but it has wonderful salads, and most, including this duck and cabbage salad that I just think it's almost French, you know, it's like duck with cabbage, is almost like an Alsatian dish, but it's spun in a Vietnamese way. And everything is covered with a shower of fried shallots, which is one of my favorite Vietnamese ingredients, you know, just these browned, sweet, nutty shallots that go in all their salads, and they're really terrific.
Well, they have a nice website, greenleaftaste.com.
And they're very friendly. It's a nice, the Labor Temple place is a nice, spacious restaurant, so it's comfortable. It's a really nice place.
Well, that'd be great, because other places have tried to be in that Labor Temple space, and they've struggled. I would like somebody to be able to be solid. That neighborhood could use a nice restaurant, and
it could
be nice.
Yeah, it's a tricky one because it's not super visible from the street. But on the plus side, the parking's not as bad as it
right.
is elsewhere.
That's right. They have the special combo rice salad. It's a picture of it here that just looks great with this fried egg right on top of all mm-hmm. these other things.
What doesn't taste good with a fried egg on top?
You are so right, madam. You are so completely correct. Greenleaf Vietnamese restaurant. So one's in the Belltown at the Labor Temple mm-hmm. there at 2800 First, and the other one's 418 8th Avenue South. So it's in the ID.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Or is they right here? Chinatown. That's what they call it. Greenleaf Vietnamese restaurants. Also the Marcella Hazan's Essentials of Classic Italian Cooking, a book that we should pick up and then practice in that artichoke dish. I want to practice that. You'll tell me if I do a good job if I bring it in, right?
Oh, please do.
Sarah Dickerman writes for Slate, New York Times. She's been a cook. She's blogging at sarahdickerman.com. Do you say cook or chef, by the way, for yourself?
I say cook. I was never
in charge. Chef is like, yeah.
Yeah, you're in charge. You're the chief.
Yeah, that's why they say chef.
Mm-hmm.
You have that honorific, that title. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bernard Ouellette's our engineer. He's getting hungry. Weekday is produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Magano, Amin Al-Sadi, Andy Hurst, all hungry. Danielle Anthony Goodwin is our intern. I'm your host, Steve Scher. I'm hungry. I hope you're hungry. And then we'll talk again tomorrow. This is Weekday.
A massive manhunt is on for an ex-Los Angeles police officer accused of killing three people. The latest in the news just ahead. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
KUOW and Seattle's Chinatown International District present the Lunar New Year Festival, featuring a neighborhood food walk, lion and dragon dances, and other cultural performances. February 9th from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. in and around Hinghe Park. More on the events page at KUOW.org.
What are your thoughts on tipping? We know that some folks rely on tips to augment their salary. Perhaps you're one of them, or have in the past worked for tips. How do you handle tipping? Do you have a formula you use? 10%, 15%, 20%? Under what circumstances would you stiff your server? Or maybe leave a bigger tip? Help us figure this out. Share your thoughts on tipping right now by calling 206-221-3663. 206-221-3663. And we want to hear from folks on both sides of the issue, people who leave tips and people who work for tips. 206-221-3663. Then join us today at noon for that conversation.
Support for KUOW comes from Kitsap Propane, with propane tank monitor.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.